This episode of Dummy is brought to you by Who Are Ya? Check out WhoAreYaDesigns.com for the most clever soccer shirts in all the land. Whether you follow the English Premier League, MLS, or your favorite national teams, Who Are Ya has a shirt for you. Right now, they're offering free shipping to all Dummy listeners when you use promo code DUMMY at checkout. That's D-U-M-M-Y. Enter it in, and you'll get free shipping on your order at WhoAreYaDesigns.com.
Hello and welcome to Dummy, a weekly conversation between editors and friends of Howler magazine. I must be one of the friends because I'm not an editor and I'm also not George Qureshi. George is lounging on a beach somewhere on a honeymoon vacation. My name is Daniel Alarcón. I'm a writer and the executive producer of a Spanish language narrative journalism podcast called Radio Ambulante, and I'll be filling in for George this week. Joining me is the only member of the podcast to date to have scored a goal for Arsenal. He now works as a scout for the Gunners in the United States. Daniel Carbassion. Hi, Danny.
How's it going, man?
Pretty well, thank you. And joining us from Bristol, England, is the author of The Ball is Round and Futebol Nation. You may know him as the man with Shakespeare's accent and Kyle Beckerman's hair. I have not Googled that, so I cannot confirm. David Goldblatt. Hi, David.
Hi.
So we are all getting over the World Cup hangover, shielding our eyes from the sun and the news. It's been a rough week. We've had a little time to think about what went on last month, and I wanted to talk a little bit about that and some of the takeaways from the tournament, some of the things that might have slipped through the cracks. We've had big moves in the market, the transfer market already, and we're going to just take a look at all this. We also want to talk about the 2018 World Cup in Russia and specifically the ongoing conflict in Ukraine and how that may affect things as they unfold over there. Also, in this episode of the podcast, we're going to sit down with writer and art historian Teju Cole to talk about his amazing crowdsourcing project, The Time of the Game, and also the impact of social media on this last World Cup. And last, but definitely not least, we'll announce the winner of the FIFA contest. That's right. You're just minutes away from finding out who's headed to Portland to play FIFA against the players of the Bayern Munich and the MLS All-Stars. So let's not get ahead of ourselves. Let's start with the World Cup. David and Danny, I wanted to start with this. If tiki-taka died in this last tournament, then what is it? What replaced it?
I wouldn't particularly say tiki-taka died, and we spoke about this pretty extensively throughout the tournament as we kept asking when the Spanish went out what exactly happened, and is tiki-taka in fact dead? But I don't think it's dead. I think there's still elements of it that the teams that did play well and advanced quite far into the tournament that they utilized throughout the tournament. I think it's transformed into a style that still requires quite a high technical ability in order to, in order to perform. But now it seems as if teams are actually starting to use an out and out striker with it, which makes it even more deadly. I mean, Germany started out the tournament playing Thomas Müller without an out and out striker, and then they ended up using Klose in the later rounds of it. But still, you see the players, they tend to press high. They're able to keep the ball, control the ball. They're able to retain possession and turn defense into attack quite quickly when they do get the ball. And all those players that played in Germany's midfield and they're attacking three, they're all very technically gifted players that are very aware of their surroundings. They're aware of where their teammates are on the pitch, where they are on the pitch, as well as the defense. And these are all little aspects of the game needed to play that at that speed and that level. So I don't think it's dead. I think it's just the natural progression of the style of the game and what's required to win these days.
David?
I thought there was also, just thinking of the Germans, just more direct attacking intent. And I was struck by two of the best goals they scored came from, runs down the wing and fantastic crosses into the box. I mean, that's how they won the final. And, you weren't seeing that, from the Spanish at their height, and adding that dimension, to a close possession, high line, high pressing game makes it, I think, particularly devastating.
Yeah, one of the things that people always said about Spain, always hear boring Spain. And I didn't hear anyone say that about Germany.
Yeah, I don't, it's because it wasn't boring, and David just hit on it. They had that more direct, a little bit more direct style of play, and they were able to do that because they play with a proper striker as well. I mean, Spain tried doing it with Diego Costa, but I think he was so new into the team and it just didn't particularly gel the right way. But with a guy like, even when Muller did play up there, he did a good job. I mean, he'd get wide sometimes and leave them without any proper target man occasionally. But with Klose up there, they're able to have a direct outlet straight up the pitch. And I think that's what, as David said, that's what made it more exciting, is that they were able to go straight forward instead of side to side all the time.
And when there was a lot of close passing, you know, it was often very directional and, you know, aimed at goal. There were some fantastically exciting interchanges inside the box amongst the German players that resulted repeatedly in shots on target.
Yeah, absolutely. What struck me was that, in terms of overlaps between Spain and Germany and the last two World Cups, is that both winning teams were teams, as opposed to teams built around a star. And it struck me that when Spain tried to build around Diego Costa, or at least make him the fulcrum of the attack, it just flopped completely. But it did seem, you know, I think we can say now with all certainty that the best team won. Moving on, I want to talk a bit about CONCACAF, seeing as this is a U.S. Soccer podcast. Is that growth of CONCACAF here to stay? Is that something we're going to see in future tournaments?
I think so. I mean, I think CONCACAF is quite a strong region anyway. Whether or not we're here to stay, I think, you know, Costa Rica had an excellent performance, and I think they, in the minds of many, they overachieved in terms of getting as far as they did. Mexico and the U.S., I think at this point we expect both of our countries to at least get out of our group, and now I think expectations are getting to the point where we hope to at least win one game in the knockout stages as well, you know. And if we're able to have three teams consistently getting out of the group and challenging in that knockout stage, and that's definitely meaningful. But I think for Mexico and the U.S. for sure at this point, and you know, a lot of people had written us off in terms of especially getting out of the group of death, but I think at this point, whenever we get to the World Cup, we're expecting to get out of the group and at least have one more game, if not another.
I was going to say, the thing with CONCACAF though is it's a really long tail. I mean, you know, Mexico and the US, I think we can look forward to them being at the World Cup pretty much every time the tournament comes around. And as you say, making it through at the very least to the round of 16. Costa Rica, of course, you know, a little bit of a one-off. Perhaps it will be repeatable. Perhaps another small Central American country or Costa Rica again will be able to do that. But after that, as we know, the tail is very long. A lot of small islands that are just not going anywhere.
Yeah, and they won't get anywhere. I wanted to switch gears just a little bit because, the tournament is over and we are now in full-on transfer season. And before we get into that, I wanted to ask you, Danny, you are a former player. What is the process like for getting transferred or loaned out? How much do players know about how much do they care even about the rumors that are swirling around them?
I think they certainly care about the rumors and want to know exactly where they'll be headed. It's a process where you essentially leave it up to your agent and hope that he does the best. And there's players always in different situations. You know, if you're coming off a very good year where you've either, you know, scored a lot of goals or you've had an exceptional season, then the offers will start coming in. But if you find yourself in a situation where you've possibly been released and you're on a free transfer, then it might be a little bit different. Sometimes that's obviously more appealing for clubs will come in, but that's usually sorted. If they know your contract's going to be out, that'll generally get sorted within the 6 months, you know, before the season ends. But you keep in contact with your agent quite a bit. When I was at Arsenal and I went on loan to Ipswich Town, it actually happened the day before. My agent called me and said, Danny, Ipswich want you on loan. And I was actually heading home. I had been given 4 or 5 days off at Christmas time at Arsenal, and I wasn't needed in the first team there. So they said, you can go home. And my agent called and said, Danny Ipswich want you on loan. The loan will start tomorrow if you want it. And I was literally meant to be on a flight going back to the U.S. That next day, and I ended up being on the bench against Wigan at Portman Road the next night instead. So it is, I mean, it is pretty crazy. I mean, even looking back now and looking at that experience, you know, I was 20 years old and going to another, once again, you go to another foreign city in a country that's quite foreign to you, and you're in a dressing room where nobody knows you. You have to prove yourself once again. And this happens, you know, across the board in the game. Whenever you leave one team and go to another, it's obviously different for some players who are, you know, massively established and come in with a huge repertoire behind them. But yeah, I think it's an interesting time, you know, and the players will just make sure they keep contact with their agents as much as possible, and their agents are doing everything they can. This is when they make their money. So this is when they're doing everything they can to earn it.
And how much does it affect the psychology? I mean, it can be, sounds incredibly unsettling just to not know.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it is really unsettling. Even when I left Arsenal, these are all just personal things, but when I left Arsenal, I was out of contract and five or six championship clubs kind of came in for me. And after speaking with Burnley, my agent and I decided that would be kind of the right move for me in terms of, you know, who they had in their team and, in terms of playing time and all that sort of stuff. But yeah, you don't know. You know, for me, I was keen on kind of staying in London because I'd grown to love London. But if no teams in London want you, then it makes it a bit of a different situation, you know? It is a pretty unsettling experience because you kind of have no idea where you'll spend the next couple years of your life, you know?
Yeah. David, you were saying before we started recording that you have a policy against talking about transfers in the summer.
I just have to let the brain circuits cool down and take a break and walk away. I mean, I don't know about you, but the World Cup sent mine humming and I just, it's overload. And I think so much of the news, is manufactured, in the off season. Some of it deliberately, by agents who play all sorts of interesting games with the press and with, various possible clubs that their clients could go to. And some of it's just made up to fill the space when nothing else is going on. So I kind of think it best not to encourage them and just re-engage when it's all done.
Well, does someone have an exciting thing to say about, or an interesting thing to say then about the transfers that we've seen? Danny, maybe you might be the one to carry the water on this one, huh?
The things we've seen, I guess, from an Arsenal standpoint, us signing Alexis Sanchez is certainly exciting. I think it's exciting too for the Premier League, seeing a player of his quality come into the league. He's exciting. He's creative. I think it'll make the overall league more exciting, especially with the fact that the controversially exciting Luis Suarez has left and gone to Barcelona. You know, I think it'll be quite nice to get a little more Latin flavor back in the league, and it doesn't hurt that it's coming to Arsenal.
Absolutely, and then there's the whole Fabregas moving to Chelsea thing, and Costa trying out the new league. I'm looking forward to it. Although, David, I completely understand your point of view. I think there's a lot of sanity in your statement, but it's hard, you know, if you're a fan not to get caught up in it.
Oh, for sure. You know, it's hard to resist. You know, I'm even as I hear the words Fabregas thinking, that's an interesting thing, but I'm resisting.
good for you. Good for you. I for one applaud your restraint that I certainly don't have. Okay, let's take a quick break, and up next we'll talk about the next World Cup, Russia 2018, and other recent world events that maybe should have FIFA second guessing that choice. So, obviously this is a soccer show and that's why you're listening, but it's hard not to mention the major news of this past week, which, like many weeks, was dominated by war and conflict. I'm speaking, of course, of Gaza and the Ukraine. The situation in Ukraine is completely relevant to soccer, and to the World Cup coming up in 2018. A lot of Western leaders are pointing the finger at Russian President Vladimir Putin's possible involvement in the conflict and the shooting down of the Malaysian Airlines passenger jet. So a lot of people are talking about the possibility of this being sort of the tipping point and a reason to push the World Cup and take the World Cup out of Russia in 2018. David, what role can FIFA play here? Is moving the World Cup at this point even an option?
Well, I think the thing is there's already a process actually at work over the 2018 World Cup, which is part of the wider investigation that's going on into the allocation of the 2022 World Cup to Qatar, and the investigation as to whether there was anything improper in that bidding process has been extended to both World Cups and all participants. So FIFA, to be fair to them, can't really start commenting on the location of World Cups until their own kind of, you know, investigation has been concluded. And I think that's, you know, we're going to hear something about that in September. The second thing, I think that, you know, makes it problematic for FIFA is that until FIFA has really put its own house in order, until FIFA is an exemplar of democracy, of transparency, of reasoned decision-making processes, it's very hard for it to start lecturing states like Russia over its human rights and foreign policy record. I mean, I'm not saying that these should not be matters of concern for the football community or part of the decision-making process when World Cups are allocated, but I think FIFA is, you know, its hands are actually pretty tied. Who can take FIFA seriously on, you know, the protection of human rights in Russia, given how little it's done so far on, you know, labor issues in Qatar? So I think we're going to have to wait for another couple of months before FIFA can actually even begin to take an intelligent position on this.
Danny?
I mean, much of what David said, I agree. I think what's a shame is that both, you know, in 8 years, we're going to have two World Cups in two places that are already under so much scrutiny, you know, and, I know Brazil was under a lot of, under the magnifying glass heading into it, but they were able to pull off an exceptional show in the end. You know, one certainly without controversy, or one with controversy, but still. But I just wonder if Russia, I mean, Russia in particular, I don't know. I've never actually been to Russia, but I've been doing quite a bit of reading on it, especially with them having the Olympics and stuff and seeing, several of my friends, took part in it and just seeing how the country is prepared and how they can deal with having such a massive event. And with the Olympics, I think it's interesting because it's just in one city and it was in Sochi. And with the World Cup going there, you'll get a much larger view of what the country, is all about. And I don't know if, you know, I know they have 4 years to get ready for this, but, are they ready to have to open up to the world and have everybody in, especially with all this, political drama happening now?
Yeah, I mean, on the other hand, the you know, there's the argument, and I know George brought this up on a prior show, that the kind of eyes on the world being on Russia could do quite a bit for helping open up the country. I mean, that's the argument that people make, right? About these, you know, giant global sporting spectacles, that the attention of the world can help open up political dialogue and shine a spotlight on, you know, democratic forces or whatnot. Is that just a bunch of talk? Is there any truth to that?
I think it is true. And I think it's more true now than it was, you know, 10, 20 years ago, because the degree of, you know, access to social media and mobile telephony means that, you know, however manicured the spectacle, however much, you know, the powers that be want to take control of the story and the presentation, they just can't anymore. They can't do it. They can't exclude other voices. They can't exclude the sort of thousands of alternative viewpoints that you get when these events occur. And, I think that was one of the most exciting things about Brazil, is not just the story you were hearing through the mainstream media, but the stories you were hearing, you know, through Twitter and through a whole variety of blogs. And I think that really blows a place open. And, it would be, all other things being equal, I think it would be really good for the world and for Russia to get to know each other a little better.
Yeah, yeah, no, absolutely. Even in a democracy, you know, like Brazil, there was a lot of abuse and a lot of trampling of rights and a lot of allegations of violence around the setting up of the World Cup and the infrastructure development and the stadium construction and evictions and all this stuff. So one can only imagine what might happen in a situation like Russia's, you know, where we do have someone like Putin who's just an authoritarian, essentially.
Yeah, but if we're gonna, you know, democracies can make bad urban planning decisions as well and displace people. I mean, enormous numbers of people were moved for Seoul 1988. Sydney 2000 certainly got its hands dirty. So, you know, giving a mega event to a liberal democracy is no guarantee necessarily that these things will be done as well as we would like. I think the other thing is that it's a really interesting opportunity. Again, when FIFA has put its house in order and got a degree of legitimacy, to start actively shaping these urbanization processes rather than just handing over the brand and saying, okay, guys, you get on with it. As long as you've got enough, you know, space in the VVIP area for the, you know, they specify 5.7 meters squared per person in VVIP, which is three times the amount of space allocated to people in the expensive seats, let alone those in the cheap seats. Anyway, they, you know, we could also be saying, look, if you want to put in a World Cup, we want to see what is your legacy to grassroots football. What percentage of your spending on stadium infrastructure are you going to spend on all-weather pitches, you know, for kids in the same city? How are you going to, you know, we should be looking to award World Cups on the basis of, you know, how well you're going to leverage your sponsors to support grassroots football or, you know, similar kind of training programs. So there are all sorts of opportunities when the governance of FIFA and international football is in a better shape to be more activist and to start engaging with these processes. And let's face it, you know, Olympics or not, World Cup or not, the global South is going through an explosive period of urbanization. This stuff is going to happen. Let's make it an opportunity to shape it in a progressive way.
And now, I'm sorry, I'm 37 years old, and you said when FIFA gets its house in order, and I don't think I'm going to see that in my lifetime.
Ah, pessimism of the intellect, optimism of the will.
Well, you know, we'll just leave it at that. I mean, I agree with you on your analysis, and it's just that there's a hint of optimism in that statement, which I just can't help but bristle at. I mean, FIFA, we all know, you know, and I don't know if we saw those pictures of Sepp Blatter sitting next to Putin, and they just looked so comfortable together, as if they'd known each other for years, you know.
Well, I mean, it's not like they haven't met before. And, you know, I'm sure they've got plenty of power play strategies to discuss the finer points of these matters.
Yeah, no, it wasn't just that they'd known each other for years. It's if they were like two souls of, you know, kindred spirits, you know. Anyway, that was just me reading into an AP photo or something. Anyway, we should move on. I want to thank you both for that conversation. Up next, we're going to hear something a little bit different. We're joined by the writer, novelist, essayist, art historian, Teju Cole. He's going to tell us about a really incredible crowdsourced art project that was called The Time of the Game, and specifically about the role of social media, the role social media played in this World Cup. He's going to be joining us via Skype from Switzerland. One second. I wanted to talk to you, Teju, because it seemed to me that this was the World Cup of social media in some ways.
Yeah.
And if any sort of sporting event or international spectacle was sort of tailor made for social media as a communication tool, it seems like the World Cup was that. How did you see it? Was that something that you noticed? Were you looking forward to sort of the World Cup on social media?
I really was. You know, this is technically maybe the second World Cup properly on social media, because I don't remember 2006 really being quite so networked, but 2010 was, and for me that was sort of like a Facebook World Cup with my friend Siddhartha Mitter. We like set up a little Facebook thing. We'd talk about every match, and people showed up for that. But you know, that was, we're talking maybe a couple dozen people. You know, we had our regulars from the States and from Germany and from Nigeria and from Australia who joined us. So that was kind of a fun sort of thing. But Twitter took it to a whole other level. And suddenly you're watching with hundreds of people who you expect to see in the course of a game. You know, you came to rely on people for reactions and for quips and for insight and for ridiculousness. It became like a very loud and very big bar. You know, I thought it was going to be a good fit for the for social media. But what surprised me was the extent to which that was where the games happened. You know, before the World Cup began, I knew that I was going to be too busy to actually commit to writing pieces for anyone and any of the people who invited me to write regular pieces for them. But I really expected I would be experiencing the World Cup through your writing and through Rabi, through Sasha and through Rowan, because, you know, you guys are my cohort. And I did a fair bit of that reading, but it also turned out that Twitter was actually the place to be and to engage with that crowd and with other crowds, crowds of people who were not writers, but who were also reacting to the game. So it wasn't just a social media World Cup for me. It was very much a Twitter World Cup, especially since, you know, for most of it, I was actually way out here in Switzerland, and quite a few matches I went out to like view in centers and saw with crowds of people. But I found that I actually had more fun watching at home, and I had a couple of screens up and I was interacting with people and I was on the computer at the same time. It gave me a kind of a bar atmosphere in environments of my own home, you know, right. Zero risk of anyone puking on me.
Right.
Except, you know, right. If it was me puking on myself, and that didn't happen.
What about this hashtag, the time of the game that you did? Could you talk about that?
Yeah. So that came at the very end, right? At the end of like a month of watching this stuff online. And, you know, in a way, I'm kind of addressing my friends. I'm addressing my fellow nerds and people who sort of understand the way I interpret the world, or, you know, my own peculiar sense of humor, my fondness for puns and all of that. And that was sort of the way I called these games. It was just a real time for me to be silly. But I also sort of was aware of probably how annoying that got for people who, A, cared nothing for that kind of humor, whatever. So whatever. It was a month in which I gained a lot of new followers and lost a lot of followers. But, you know, you kill your darlings, right?
Right.
But towards the end, when it became clear that this was kind of a consolidation of a group of people who had not really come together in this way before. Now, there are a lot of football fans out there. It is the world's biggest event. It's bigger than the Olympics. Social media made it visible in a new way. I just sort of got this idea that thing I used to do with flowers, where I would have people on a Sunday morning send me flowers, photos of flowers from wherever it was they were in the world. I thought, why don't I do that with something less pretty than flowers? And so I decided to do it with football, with TV screens.
If folks haven't seen it, it's pretty stunning just to have these overlaid images and watch the game progress and jump. Just imagine these images are coming from everywhere, you know?
Yeah, and it just became a kind of practice of, I mean, okay, as an art historian, I am interested in, you know, the interesting things people can do with contemporary material to make art. And so not long ago, I wrote an essay about a woman who uses Google search to compile images and to make art. And so that kind of thing interests me, but it also interests me just on the level of the kind of conversations that we have about, you know, who's in and who's out. Like me, you've also experienced the United States as a place that can be a little bit narrow in its conception of who's in and who belongs and who should be part of our conversation. As novelists, as creative people, we want to cast the net a bit wider, right? We want to make it a bigger conversation. And this was just such a straightforward way of doing that, because suddenly I get, you know, contributions from people in Beirut, and people in Accra, people in Karachi, like people in Sydney and in Oslo. This was my world. I mean, quite apart from the football, this was just the world of my imagination and the range of people I interact with and wish to interact with. So that the football almost became an excuse to have a conversation with very many people. At the risk of sounding suddenly like a, you know, a UN diplomat, this became an opportunity for a kind of distributed democracy that had nothing to do with terrorism and immigration, or, you know, one group of people being above another people, or about war, or about insulting anyone. It was just, here is this one almost trivial thing that we all love, and here is this time, this 120 minutes time in which we can all experience it together. And that just became its own narrative. I really enjoyed it. And I should mention Jer Thorpe, the data artist who helped me make the vision real. This is another further level of what, you know, I mean, Twitter can be such a pain in the ass. There's so many random people saying so much random crap to you. But it's also the kind of place where I can just reach out to this guy, a brilliant data artist, and just say, hey, do you want to envision this thing with me and see what can come of it? And it was like, yeah, dude, I'm down. I'm down with that. And he came up with something amazing. I mean, I have like a whole bunch of followers. I could put out a call and get all this raw material and give them instructions of what kind of image I want from them. And then he can come up with something that honors that raw material. And this is the kind of collaboration that you know, would put this together in 3 days. And he had the code up and ready to go.
It's beautiful, man. We'll definitely include a link to it on the website here. So thank you so much for taking the time.
Thanks very much, Daniel. It's good to talk to you about it. Now that World Cup is over, we've got to figure out what to do with our lives.
Up next, we'll wrap things up with our Tiki Taka segment and announce the winner of our EA Sports FIFA competition. All right, we're almost out of time, but before we go, let's do Tiki Taka, where each of our panelists brings up one thing that they love from the past week in the soccer world. Danny, let's start with you.
Yeah, so one really interesting story coming out of Seattle from this weekend was the Make-A-Wish Foundation granted a pretty incredible wish to an 18-year-old boy whose name is Xander Bailey, who is battling cystic fibrosis, but his dream was always to become a professional soccer player. And the Seattle Sounders allowed him to sign a professional contract, give a press conference, meet the media, and then they played Tottenham Hotspur this weekend in a friendly game at CenturyLink, and he actually got to kick off with Clint Dempsey, played a 1-2 with him, and took a shot on Brad Friedel in front of a packed house in Seattle, which was pretty awesome. I know there's, you know, if you've been watching the news this week, it's been quite horrible with everything that's been going on around the world, and seeing this kid smile like really, really, it was quite warming. It was pretty awesome seeing it. So I thought that was really awesome.
Yeah, I saw that. It was really lovely, really moving. It reminded me of the, you know, it was movie-esque. It was very Hollywood, but yeah. just really, really nice scenes. David, do you have something equally heartwarming?
Not quite heartwarming, indeed. Relentless self-promotion, but I just wanted to highlight a new book out called Football in the 1970s, edited by Rule Golden and published by Taschen. And it's a photographic book and it's absolutely sensational. It must be 400 pages in color, fantastic production values, ludicrously cheap, and just the most amazing selection of football photos from that decade all over the world. I was looking today at a double page spread of the confetti and toilet paper being thrown at the beginning of a game in the 1978 World Cup. Absolutely unbelievable. And, you know, I do have a small essay in it, but that's really the least of it. This is a book of pictures to savor. So go get it.
That sounds great. Well, I'll, you know, on that, I'll just mention that my my son bought me a late Father's Day gift of Los Mil Mejores Jugadores de la Historia del Fútbol, the 1,000 greatest soccer players of in the history of soccer, which is also a very nice book. We got it in Spanish in Colombia just now. And I actually looked through it and found a couple of my countrymen, a couple of Peruvian players in there. And that was always nice. And I got to tell him who they were and remind him that one day Peru will be in the World Cup again. So anyway, that's great. One last thing. I guess before we wrap this up, we have to announce a winner for our latest, competition with EA Sports. Many of you sent in submissions pleading your case as to why you should be the one to go to Portland, Oregon and play FIFA with the players from Bayern Munich and the MLS All-Stars. Here is your winning submission.
This is Mark Dancer calling in from Fort Smith, Arkansas. As a lifelong fan of soccer, I was first annoyed by my friend Jacob's jabs at soccer during the 2010 World Cup. By the end of the tournament, however, he was hooked. He has since become an avid Tottenham supporter, and we travel to an FC Dallas match every year. So is it right that this new fan is flying halfway across the country to see the All-Star game from partially obstructed view seats in Portland when I have never been to one? Certainly not. As the dude would say, this aggression will not stand, man. I have loved soccer for my entire life. I watched the inaugural MLS game live on ABC. I lived through Steve Sampson and the 3-6-1. This guy can't slide in and go to the All-Star game before I do, can he? Unless, of course, I went for free. If I played FIFA with the world's best players, if I were a guest of EA Sports, if I were to swoop in and steal his glory like John Brooks against Ghana, that would be the ultimate howler.
So congratulations. Have a great time in Portland. And remember, you cannot quit FIFA mid-game, especially if you play against Schweinsteiger, because he's probably not going to like that. That does it for this episode of Dummy. I want to thank our guest, Teju Cole, for joining us on the show. Thanks to our panel, David Goldblatt and Danny Carbassion, for bringing their insight again this week. The Howler Singers are led by Lindsay Elliott. They're members of the choral ensemble Ghostlight, and they made our theme tune. I really like that song, actually. I think it's quite nice. All the rest of the music is by Brian Kim. Most of all, thank you to you, the listeners. Thank you for subscribing on iTunes. And if you haven't yet, you should go out and do it. And following us on Twitter and Instagram. We are What a Howler. This podcast was produced by Matthew Nelson with help from Ryan Catanese, Kira Diepenprock, and Malena Barajas. I'm Daniel Alarcón. George Koresh will be back with you next week with all the rest of these dummies. We'll see you then.
This episode of Dummy is brought to you by Who Are Ya? Check out WhoAreYaDesigns.com for the most clever soccer shirts in all the land. Whether you follow the English Premier League, MLS, or your favorite national teams, Who Are Ya has a shirt for you. Right now, they're offering free shipping to all Dummy listeners when you use promo code DUMMY at checkout. That's DUMMY. Enter it in, and you'll get free shipping on your order at WhoAreYaDesigns.com.